Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Ben Witchell. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well, thank you, Chris, yeah.
Excellent. We're recording this in sunny Twickenham. You're the first person who's ever been to my house, well, my new house, for a podcast.
Oh, wow, that is a privilege.
Yeah, no, well, it's better than before. The only room that we could record in, because we had wooden floors everywhere and all this, and the acoustics were terrible, the only room we could record in was in my bedroom. So I used to take people up to my bedroom to record. It's like coming out, do you want to come to my bedroom and see my itchings or something? Like, mostly it was Blake, so they took it well. Okay, so you're from Flint. Is it Flint Vineyards or Flint?
Well, we're calling ourselves Flint, but yeah, we're Flint Vineyards is probably a good way of saying it. Yeah, Flint or Flint Vineyard, however you want to say it, really, yeah.
And that's in Norwich. No, Norwich, Norfolk.
That's in Norfolk, yeah. Yeah, we're close to Norwich. We're just south of Norwich. We're actually on the Norfolk-Suffolk border, so we're in south Norfolk, near a town called Bungay.
Sounds like something out of the Wombles, isn't it? Is that Bungay?
That's right, yeah, a bit like that, yeah. Wombles of Bungay, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, no one forgets Bungay, and you always sort of tend to find people that have had holidays in Bungay or they've got some family from Bungay. So it's a well-known place, but it's a lovely part of the world. There's lots of little market towns, and there's a bit of a foodie kind of revival going on there. So it's a good place to have a winery. We're hoping to step into
that. For the listeners who don't really know where Norfolk and Suffolk is, because, you know, I've been here 15 years. I sort of know where it is, but, you know, if you live in another country, pretty hard. Do you want to just describe where it is relative to maybe London or England?
Yeah, so we're kind of north east of London. I don't know how many miles. It's probably 60 odd miles, something like that.
Or about 16 hours drive.
Yes. Yeah.
It's pretty hard to get to by road.
Getting out of Norfolk is impossible, and it's getting in because you tend to get stuck behind a tractor. But on the train, it's, I don't know, because I do the train to London occasionally, it takes about... It takes about 2.5 hours to get to London, something like that, including some tubes at the other end. But we're the bit that sticks out on the east of England, and you've got Norfolk at the top, you've got Suffolk in the middle, and Essex down at the bottom, and that is generally, that's called East Anglia.
Okay, so the reason we're talking is you've got a new winery.
That's right, yeah.
And you've set up, and we're going to talk a wee bit about some research that you've been commissioned to do next week.
That's it,
But I thought we'd just have a wee chat about Norfolk, because a lot of people, Suffolk, East Anglia, if you like, a lot of people in the UK, when we think about wine, we think about the sparkling wines from England.
Yeah.
And a lot of the really good stuff that I've seen anyway comes from Sussex, bit of Kent, down in Cornwall, if you want to be nice to Bob Lindo and his lot down there.
Certainly, yeah.
But I don't really think of East Anglia. I know East Anglia Wine Vineyard Association is quite a strong one. I see them at the English Trade Show all the time, but I don't really know of any really strong producers that are based up there. So do you want to just give us a sort of an overview of what's going on in East Anglia and Norfolk in particular?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, East Anglia, particularly sort of Norfolk and Suffolk, is probably less well known to the average sort of wine consumer in England. As you say, most of the plantings have taken place in Sussex, primarily sort of East Sussex and West Sussex, where you've got a lot of chalk. So people naturally thought that south of England, the latitude is close to France, it's going to be warmer. And obviously in Cornwall, it is a very warm part of England. It's probably the lowest latitude on the British Isles, possibly apart from the Isle of Wight. So you would naturally, if you're going to plant a vineyard, probably go as far south as possible. But when you look at the sort of climate gradient across England, you've actually got a band that runs from the sort of east part of sort of South Norfolk down to Cornwall, and you actually find that the climate is actually quite uniform from that band. I've actually done quite a lot of mapping using Met Office data going back sort of to the sort of 60s, basically, using daily sort of temperature averages. And you find that the temperature is actually very similar from somewhere like South Norfolk, where we are, down to Cornwall. But the difference with East Anglia is that it's very dry. Yeah. So particularly in the ripening months, where you want the grapes to be hanging on the vines for as long as possible. So October time, we get very dry climate, which is perfect, because you have the advantage of possibly being able to sort of hang the grapes a bit longer and hopefully get a bit of extra sugars into the grapes. So we're a lot drier. I think we have, in October, we have at least half the rainfall that some parts of the southwest have, because it's a bit of a rain shadow in Norfolk.
Yeah.
So the rain comes across from the southwest, and by the time it gets to Norfolk, it's dropped off. So the Norfolk Tourist Board actually promote Norfolk as the combined sunniest, driest county in the whole of the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to try and entice people to come there. And that's taken from Met Office figures. So there's something in it. You know, it is dry. And some of the vineyards that are starting to do really well, there's a guy a bit further north of us in a place called Surlingham called Wimbury. It's run by the Dyer family. And they're doing fantastically well. They're making some excellent backers. And a bit further south, you've got places like Giffords Hall, which are also doing very well, and that's into Suffolk. And then further down in Essex, you've got places like Newhall Vineyard, which are making wonderful backers. And it does seem to be that the varieties that are suited to still wine grow particularly well here, particularly backers, which is quite a vigorous variety. And the dry climate of Norfolk and Suffolk and Essex seems to suit it quite well.
We'll get on to backers in a wee bit. Sparkling wine is what everybody's making because it's a crop that generates the cash. You know, you get a kilo of wine grapes for sparkling wine, and you can charge £15-25 for a bottle of sparkling wine. England really struggles to clear £10, maybe £11 for a bottle of still white wine. So you know the margin appears to be in the sparkling wine because the incremental cost of production isn't that high, really, compared to what the premium for the price you can get for the wine.
No, in relation, it's probably not. I mean, you've got the disgorging and you've got, obviously, the ageing. You need to have it in a cellar for 18 months, over 2 years, really, if you're trying to get very serious about making a really good sparkling wine. So those are all added costs in the production cycle. But, no, you're right. If you would be considered a bit bonkers to go and make still wine in England. Because there
so are, how's the still wine business going, mate?
It's great. I love it, yeah. I've got a really good business plan.
Twitch is really funny you've got there.
Right, yeah. A few people have said that recently, yeah. No, I mean, there are some producers that are actually starting to make really good still wines which are commanding sort of a bit better prices. You've got some places in West Sussex. There's one guy Stopham Vineyard, a guy called Simon. He's doing incredibly well. He makes a lovely Pinot Blanc and a Pinot Gris, and he also blends it with a bit of Bacchus as well to get a bit of aroma. And he's charging good money for his still wine. And then when you look at it like that, if you can charge sort of £14-15 a bottle, your margins are a bit better. And that's what we hope to do, because what we're going to be doing, and we haven't got a winery yet, we're putting that in this year, and we're planting the vines this year as well, so we won't get our first harvest until 2019. But in the intervening years, we're going to be buying grapes from local East Anglian vineyards. But we are going to put in the top equipment, inert gas press and a proper inert gas system, and try and do everything as well as you can. And part of this research grant, I know we'll talk about that another time, is going to be sort of focusing on just trying to do things innovatively. And particularly with still wines in England, you're after a very aromatic style, so you want to retain all those aroma compounds. And so it's a bit different to making a Chardonnay in the Languedoc, where you could probably get away with some oxidative pressing and, slightly oxidative fermentation and MLF in barrels. If you did that with a Bacchus or some of the grape varieties we've got here, it just doesn't have the same effect. You lose all the aromas, and we're trying to create a different product. So, if you can focus on the styles that are right for England, and people are starting to do that now with, as I said, Stopham, and then you've got some wonderful Bacchus wines as well. I think we can be compared with still wines as well as sparkling wines to the rest of the world. You're quite right to say that we're only really, on a global scale, people are talking about sparkling.
You said that at about £15 you think it stacks up as a business. What is the incremental cost, do you think, for holding a wine for 2 years and doing the disgorgement and all that sort of stuff? What sort of cost do you think that adds to a bottle of wine?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to factor in the cost of keeping it for 2 years, so you've lost 2 years' worth of cash.
Like 10% return, 20% cost?
Yeah, something like that. And then, if you are disgorging your wine, if you were going to pay a contract disgorger to disgorge your wine, take the cap off, and then top it up with the dosage, I think that would cost you about £3.50, something like that, maybe.
Oh, yeah. So it does take.
It does put a bit on if you're doing that on a contract surface, plus the fact you've got it sitting around in the cellar for a long time. But if you've got a big enough place and you can do all of that yourself, then you obviously save you save some money on
that. Yeah. So I suppose if you're saying it's a 15 quid bottle of wine, 20% cost to carry for the holding the stock for 2 years, and then which is 6 quid, and then another not 6 quid, can't even do basic maths, £3,
yeah,
and then another £3 for disgorgement and rat. So you're looking at £6, gets you up to £21, sort of, which is as cost.
Yeah, and that's probably the base cost for a sparkling wine in England.
Yeah,
yeah.
21 to 25 is where you see a lot of the.
That's right. Yeah,
that's where the price should be, I think.
I agree with you, actually. Yeah, I think, and that's another interesting point about sparkling wine, is where's that price going to go? Are you going to have 35 quid being acceptable, or is it going to come under £20, or is it going to stick around that mark that you suggest, which is £21 to £25?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. And with your wines, where are you trying to hope to pitch them in? Is it around that £15 price point?
Yeah, that's what we're looking at doing, somewhere between £13 and £15 for still wine. So yeah, I mean, we're hoping. We're going to plant some Bacchus, we're going to plant some Pinot Blanc, because I think that'll possibly ripen a bit better than Chardonnay where we are, and it could make a very interesting still wine. Pinot Blanc will also be a very good base for sparkling wine as well. So it gives us a bit of flexibility. So we're hoping to possibly make a rosé from some Pinot Noir, possibly make a sparkling from some Pinot Blanc and maybe some Pinot Noir, but also still from Bacchus and maybe Pinot Blanc as well, just a bit of flexibility. So if we were looking at rosé, really well-made rosé, I think £13 is an acceptable price. But, the sorts of people, the sorts of consumer that are interested in English wine aren't probably the sorts of consumer that are necessarily searching out a supermarket deal. They're probably really interested in wine. They appreciate things that are different. They appreciate the fact that it's been sort of handcrafted and made by, winemaker that's really given it a lot of care and attention. And that's the kind of price point we're going for.
Okay. Do you think, well, a couple of things on that, I suppose. This wasn't quite what we were planning on talking
about.
It's quite interesting.
What are you doing to me?
I noticed Denby's is selling a wine now to Lidl, and the retail price is going to be about 7 or 8 quid.
Really?
Bottle.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That, which I was like quite surprised at the price point. I know Lidl, Denby's can make wines reasonably cheaply.
Yeah.
They've always had wines in that sort of £6-7 retail price point.
Yeah. I mean, that must be just to do with the production volumes they're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that there's another winemaker sort of close to Denby's called Litmus Wines, and they make a wine called, I think, Element. And that is a blend of some Chardonnay and some Bacchus and various other varieties of, I think they're trying to go for sort of minimum intervention type wine. So sort of, I think they're aiming to not chaptalize. I don't want to sort of be misquoted, but they're doing interesting things anyway.
Yeah.
And so the difference between them and perhaps some of the sort of slightly cheaper wines, I think, is where the price is. If you're interested in wine and you like wine, you'd be prepared to pay a bit of extra money, knowing that some thought and innovation and has gone into that wine, because it makes it a bit different, I think.
Well, let's get back to Norfolk and East Anglia. One of the things about Norfolk, this isn't really whiny, but Norfolk is supposed to have some of the blackest skies at night. Do you have?
Okay.
Yeah, because it's there's not a lot of light pollution.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, from that point, I thought you were talking about cloud cover, but
No.
Yeah, no.
Do you get good? Because we're recording this in end of January, and there's supposed to be 5 planets that you can see in the morning.
Oh, right,
yeah,
okay.
You should have a look just before daybreak.
I'll have a look tonight. Oh, well, yeah, I won't tonight.
In the morning.
So tomorrow. But, yeah, we do get lovely, lovely skies, absolutely beautiful skies. Nothing like here in London, obviously. That's one of the disadvantages of living in London. But, we get beautiful skies. The disadvantage of a clear sky at night is frost, obviously, because
that's when frost builds
up, which is every winemaker's fear.
Is frost an issue in Norfolk?
In places it is. It depends on the soil. And Thetford Forest is a very sandy area, and that can be a bit of a frost pocket. But the coast will moderate the sort of the frost.
But you're inland, what looks to be at least, 5 miles inland?
We're a bit further inland now, about sort of 15 miles, 15, 20 miles inland, something like that.
Does that give you protection from the coast?
We'll get minimal protection probably being that far inland, but there is quite a big river system around where we are, so there's a lot of water, a lot of bodies of water. Plus, it's also about the sort of topography as well. A lot of the problems with frost are localised, so if you can find a slope, which we luckily have, then hopefully in the case of a severe frost, a lot of the cold air will run down the hill and won't build up in the vineyard. So I've been doing a lot of work, a lot of thinking about frost over the last year, basically. Yeah,
so that's
one of the things I've had to do a lot of research into.
Yeah. We've been going back to Rathfinney with Mark Driver a bit, and I went and visited him just after he'd had his first was supposed to have his first crop.
Yeah.
And he planted it up and it was all looking lovely. Everything was nice and straight. You know, the tractor was GPS. And it was beautiful, absolutely beautiful, except he had forgotten about the wind. And the wind absolutely hammered him in the first year. Mm. And, you know, the next that summer I went out and he was busy erecting windbreaks left, right and centre throughout his vineyard to try and get some protection to the vines.
I know, I've seen his windbreaks. Yeah, he's had to put in artificial windbreaks. They look beautiful, actually, when you see the pictures on his website. But, yeah, I think that's something he hadn't anticipated, but because he's in a basin there, and so I think he thought he was going to have a lot of protection. But it's obviously quite windy, and you've got to be cautious of, you've got to be mindful of that. So, yeah, these things can creep up on you without even knowing.
What do you think is going to creep up and bite you?
Oh, blimey. Well, all sorts of things. So that's the thing. England is such a new region. I think you'd be a bit mad to suggest that nothing's ever going to creep up on you, or you know that if you plant with this planting density or this rootstock in this particular area, you're going to be all right. Yeah, we could have a problem with frost. We could have a problem with wind. Norfolk does have winds, and they mainly tend to be winter winds. We actually have quite warming winds in the summer, which is an advantage. And obviously, South Norfolk is less well planted than the rest of England. So that is a bit of an experiment in itself. Although it is, you know, having done the research and having sort of benchmarked against other places in East Anglia, I'm confident that it can do well. So yeah, anything could happen.
What's the soils like up there? Because if you think about England, around London, the Weald, you've got clay.
Yeah.
Then you've got the South Downs, which is chalk.
That's right, yeah.
If you go out to Wales and Scotland, it's all granite.
Mm.
But what's Norfolk and Suffolk?
Norfolk and Suffolk, I mean, you do have a lot of chalk in the underlying geology, but that's probably not what most of the soil is known for. I mean, you do in Norfolk. It's well-known farming land. So
it was peat.
Yeah, you've got a lot of peat. You've got a lot of very rich clay as well. Which is not known for grape growing at all, and it's not ideal for grape growing. But what you do have interspersed amongst all the clay is pockets of sand, which is old river basins. And where we are, which is right next to the River Waveney, is an old river basin, and all the clay is eroded away. And we're actually right opposite a gravel plant. So right opposite our vineyard, after they've planted some trees, you can't see all of the machinery. In the distance, you've got an industrial gravel plant. So they're extracting aggregates, gravel, sand. And you've got areas like this in Norfolk where they're interspersed with sand and gravel, which is more ideal for grape growing, because obviously in England one of the things we're trying to do is reduce the inherent vigour in the vine, and England tends to be a bit more vigorous than other countries because of the rainfall, because of the damp climate, and often the richer soils. So the fact that we've got some sand in Norfolk, which is also dry, I see as a positive. And in fact, the land where we're planting, It's been known, we're on a slope, and you get to the top of the slope, it's really heavy clay. You couldn't even drive a tractor in there over the winter because it would just churn up and get stuck. Yeah, you come down into our plot, and it's gravel and sand, and the drainage is beautiful. And you can pick up the sand in your hand. And we've got flint in our soil as well, which is why we call flint.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got big bits of flint, which is also a positive thing as well. But the local farmers at my plot have told me that in the past the land that I'm on is absolutely good for nothing. They've taken ploughs up there and they've wrecked the ploughs because they've been trying to drag it through really sort of harsh, coarse soils and bits of flint and stuff. And so I'm hoping that will be, you know, good for grape growing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean,
sandy soils tends to make lighter styles of wine, though, don't they? They, you know, clay often gives them, if you can get your grapes to ripen in clay,
you get
a lot of richness.
Yes,
but clay's a bit cold.
Yeah.
Sand gives you really good drainage, but the wines often, if you compare, say, sand to gravel, sandy wines always tend to be a bit lighter in style than gravelly wines.
Yeah, I've read about that, and I don't really know why, but I mean, I think
I put gravel down because it's hotter and warms up, so you get more ripeness, perhaps.
Well, yeah, you should do, and you get the reflective heat from the sun. I'm thinking with sand that hopefully it's going to devigorize the vine, so they're less vigorous, so there's less foliage, and we've got a better ratio of fruit to leaves. And if that happens, then you're going to have smaller bunches that are riper, and so potentially you could end up having, you know, riper style wine on sand. And I think it's different everywhere you go. I mean, a lot of people say you have to have champagne varieties in chalk. I don't personally think that's necessarily the case in England.
Well, Camel Valley down in Cornwall is non-chalk, and he makes some of the nicest
sparkling. He does, yeah. And he's not exclusively using champagne varieties.
Yeah. But, well, Civil Blanc one isn't as good as his sparkling
rosé. Okay. I don't know.
It's love awesome. It sparkling rosé. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. Simple Blanc.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, Sauvage. I think it's a difficult grape to deal with, and yeah. I've had some Sauvages which don't taste so good. But Bob's is a good example of that. And I just think England. You know, you can't. I don't think it's like France. You can't just say, oh, you have to be on chalk, because England is different to France. We've got a different climate, and I think the thing about being on sand and being in a soil which is slightly less. Less alkaline, so it's got a lower pH. It gives you more flexibility with rootstock selection. So if you're on a high pH soil, you've actually got less flexibility on rootstock.
There's only one from Texas, isn't it, that can grow on chalk?
It's there are a number of rootstocks that will grow on chalk, but I mean, there's Fercal, and there are a number of rootstocks. But my research suggested that the chalk tolerant rootstocks tend to be the higher sort of vigor ones.
Okay.
You struggle to find a good, well-known rootstock that's low in vigor, that's also chalk tolerant, other than Furcal, which actually Mark Driver at Rathfenny's planted on. But that's relatively new to England. So, I think there are advantages to being on sand. I don't think it's as clear-cut an answer as some people would like to make out. You know, you have to plant on chalk to make fantastic sparkling wine. It's not quite like that.
Well, I think the main thing about chalk in England is it drains.
Yeah, that's true.
Drainage is quite important. You know, everybody thinks it's raining in England. I live in London, and it doesn't rain in London half as much as people think it does. It's just overcast and miserable most of the time. It's just not wet. Like today, it wasn't particularly wet. It was humid or moist, but it wasn't wet.
No. That's the thing. No, I mean, that is one of the key advantages of chalk. It's incredibly well draining. But you know, sand is also very well draining as well. So, it's a complete experiment. We don't know whether the vines are going to take to sand. And you never know, even though you've done soil analysis and dug big pits, which we have done, you might find other things down there that you weren't 100% aware of.
Old Roman villages.
Old Roman village, yeah. you could find anything. Actually, we did have a Roman vineyard.
I was going to say, because I did a podcast a while ago, and when Roman times, the vineyards got up to Norfolk. That was about as far north, I think, as they got. And there was quite a big... It was near you, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
Where they'd found some old pollen or seeds from grapes and old posts.
There's a Roman vineyard in Ursham, which is actually the village where we're in. We're near Bungay. Bungay's the nearest sort of well-known village. We're in a little sort of hamlet next to that called Ursham. And there's a vineyard there, a Roman vineyard there. And there's been a vineyard there sort of throughout the 1700s as well. The Earl of Bygod, who was the Earl of Norfolk, had a vineyard there, and it was also famous for hot springs as well. And it was sort of, folklore has it down as a really one of the most sheltered parts of Norfolk and East Anglia, which is perhaps why there was a vineyard there. But no, yeah, it's a nice story to have a vineyard on your doorstep. But I've not been able to find the site. I've had a walk around, and depending on who you talk to, you get different stories as to exactly where it was. But
I know the person you need to talk to.
Okay.
I know the guy who did the archaeology on that site.
Oh, right.
I'll give you his contact details if you want it.
Yeah, and I'll be really interested.
Get his paper and he'll be able to show you exactly where it is.
Oh, great. I
interviewed him a wee while ago. I thought it was quite an interesting story, old Roman vineyards in England.
It is. I mean, they were going for a different style of wine, probably. Not quite, maybe not as high quality, so you can't necessarily...
Well, probably sweeter, I imagine, back in those days.
Yeah.
With all sorts of herbs and spices and God knows what else in there.
Yeah.
Okay, then. All right, Ben, I think we're going to wrap it up there. And next week, I think we'll talk a wee bit about your Bagus research that you're going to hopefully do.
Okay, fantastic. Cheers.
Cheers.